We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is hour number two of our talk show for the morning, Focus 580. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. When it comes to fighting terrorism, the question that we most often ask is this: how are we doing? Our guest for this hour of Focus 580, terrorism expert Audrey Cronin, says that the more important question is, how will it end? This morning we'll be talking about her book, How Terrorism Ends. The subtitle is Understanding the Decline and Demise of Terrorist Campaigns. It's published by the Princeton University Press. And she says that while it may seem that campaigns against terrorism or terrorist campaigns, they may seem endless, she says, in fact, they do end, and often more quickly than expected. She says that understanding the common ways that terror movements have ended can help us strategically approach today's terrorist groups, and that's what we'll talk about in this part of Focus 580. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Audrey Cronin. She's professor of strategy at the U.S. National War College in Washington, D.C. She is also a senior associate in the Changing Character of War program at the University of Oxford. And she is also the author of the book Ending Terrorism, Lessons for Defeating Al-Qaeda. And she's also co-author of Attacking Terrorism, Elements of a Grand Strategy. And of course, if you're interested in reading on the subject, you can go out and look for the book How Terrorism Ends. And as I mentioned, it's just fairly recently out. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Questions on the program here are welcome. We only ask callers to be brief and to stay on the topic, and we ask that for the sake of the show and for the other folks who might like to call in. We'd like to get in as many callers as possible and move along through the hour and stay on the topic. But, of course, if you do that, your questions, comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly your questions and comments are welcome. And Professor Cronin, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. And I think, I guess, that the basic point that you're making here, as you write here, the very first line of the conclusion of the book, it's pretty straightforward. It's that understanding how terrorism ends is the necessary first step to fashioning an effective grand strategy against any terror campaign. Well, and I wonder why it is one you would actually have to make that point. I would think that that might be obvious.
Well, you would hope that it would be obvious, but when you're in the middle of a campaign that involves this kind of horrific violence, oftentimes it's very difficult to gain any kind of perspective. So I started thinking about the endings of these campaigns many years ago when I was actually the Congressional Research Service's specialist in terrorism, and a senior senator asked me if there was any kind of broader view that we could take. He was in the midst of getting a lot of daily briefings that were quite alarming in the aftermath of September 11th. And, you know, what struck me at the moment was that these campaigns do end, and I started to talk about different typical ways that they end. And that sort of planted a seed in my mind. That was about 6 years ago. And so, you know, I went on to other things. There was a lot of anxiety. You know, I'm here in Washington, D.C., so there was a considerable amount of day-to-day worry about the very real threats that we were facing. But yet, there was little ability to kind of gain a broader picture. And so I started to write this book when I went away to Oxford University, and that's how it came about.
Yeah. And we will talk. What you do is you identify six patterns in the decline and ending of campaigns, and we can talk about those things. But I think just one other point that I think is worth mentioning, and it goes back to this idea that when you're in the middle of a campaign against a terrorist group, that you think maybe this is never going to end. But in fact, and I hope I remember this correctly, on average, terror organizations, terror groups only last, is it 8 years?
Yeah.
Is that right? So that really, and I'm sure that here we're talking about an average, so of course that means there are some that are more and there are some that are less.
Yes. And actually, that's a conservative figure. I think if you include some of the groups that only have a couple of attacks, I put together a database that was very careful about only including groups that lasted beyond, you know, a period of months. And you know, some groups have one attack and then just disappear. I didn't include those. So 8 years is the longest that I would say is the average.
Yeah. And maybe also to frame things just a little bit, I ought to ask you to briefly define what it is that we're talking about. When you talk about terrorism or when you talk about a terrorist organization, what do you mean by that?
Sure, that's a good question, and that often comes up. When I talk about terrorism, I'm talking about non-state actors using violence. I'm not talking about state terror. So this is violence from below, not above. And I'm talking about the use or threat of the use of violence for political ends against non-combatants or illegitimate targets. You know, they can also be called civilians by non-state actors. And oftentimes people argue that we have to also consider state violence, and that's definitely a legitimate point. But this book is not about state violence. There are other things that we can use, other than the word terrorism and the frameworks of research for terrorism, that we can use in order to study state uses of violence. We can call it crimes against humanity, genocide, many other things. But this book is about violence from below by non-state actors.
So basically what we're talking about is a tactic that is employed by a group of peoples, an organized group of people, and it's a tactic that's employed because they essentially, that's the only tactic that they have, because they're taking on a much bigger opponent, probably a government or a state, and
yeah.
that's they're doing it because that's really the only, the best tool that they have.
Well, I don't agree that it's the only tool that they have. Okay. Many groups argue that that's the case, and most of these groups are in positions of weakness. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that they use in order to legitimate this kind of violence. I don't believe that's a legitimate argument. That in order to kill civilians, women, children, illegitimate targets, I don't think that tactic is justified, even in a position of weakness. There are lots of other kinds of ways to mobilize popular support, and using violence as a kind of a shocking mechanism is not the most effective or the right way to do it, I believe. But you're right. This is what the groups argue.
You present a number of cases to illustrate the various ways that terror groups end. And maybe just to pull two of them out and take them out of order a little bit. And the reason that I do that is because it seems that as we think about dealing with terrorism, probably these are the first things, or at least the way that states are going to respond, the first things that are going to come to mind is as I think you say it in the book, is use of brute force, either trying to kill the leadership or doing what you can to kill all of the members, essentially using force one way or another to decapitate the organization or basically to wipe it out entirely.
Sure.
And just to take the first one, if you ask the question, well, and in how many cases has, say that's what you decide that you're going to do? You say, well, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to go after the leadership. In how many cases has that actually been the reason that a group has ended, because either the leaders were killed or that they were captured?
Actually, the so-called decapitation of a group, you know, where you kill a leader or capture a leader, is not one of the most common ways of ending, although there are some pretty well-known examples of where a group declined significantly or did come to its demise because of that. The well-known ones would be Guzman with the Shining Path, when he was arrested and put behind bars and sort of paraded in a kind of a position of humiliation. Mickey McKevitt with the Real IRA. Shoko Hasahara with Aum Shinrikyo, that certainly hurt that group a great deal. So these are all examples where leaders were arrested, and then the group's sense of power and legitimacy was deeply undermined. But there are lots of other campaigns where there have been targeted assassinations, and those may have had tactical short-term benefits preventing a group from carrying out a particular attack, but they really haven't, in the most cases, led to the ending of the group. You know, the classic situation is the targeted assassination campaigns with respect to the Palestinian groups that are using terrorism.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting you make the observation, in fact, that it can be more, if you're going to try to do that, it actually could be, it's better, it's more effective if you can capture the leader than killing the leader.
Yes. At least if you look at the historical record, it's much better if you can put someone behind bars and then undermine the sense of strength and legitimacy of the group, because the group, usually terrorism is used as a tactic, or one of the classic things that it's used for is to mobilize popular support, because one of the reasons why a group is weak is that they don't have a broad popular base. And if you can put the leader behind bars, particularly if his if there's a cult of personality that was a big motivating factor in a group, and then demonstrate his impotence and inability to do anything, that can actually undercut a group, certainly undercut its ability to have popular support. Hmm. But even putting someone behind bars occasionally has backfired. For example, with Sheikh Omar Abdullah Rahman, the blind sheikh that was involved with the 1993 World Trade Center bombings, you know, he continued to cause some activity on his behalf and to communicate from behind bars. You have to be very careful. It's also the Bader-Meinhof, when they were imprisoned, actually were inspirational for additional violence to try to free them. So you have to be very careful about how you hold people. But if you look at the record overall, arrest is more promising than is assassination.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Audrey Kurth Cronin. She's professor of strategy at the U.S. National War College in Washington, D.C. She's also senior associate in the Changing Character of War program at the University of Oxford, and has written a lot about terrorism. And we're talking about some of what you will find in her recent book, How Terrorism Ends. The subtitle is Understanding the Decline and Demise of Terrorist Campaigns. The book is published by the Princeton University Press. And in this book, she makes the argument basically that you can see six patterns in the decline and demise of terrorist campaigns, different reasons why they come to an end, anything from achieving the group's aims to becoming part of the legitimate political process, anything from that to simply being wiped out one way or another. And she says that in order to make policy now and talk about what we're doing with terrorism now, it's important to understand this. And take that into account. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess the reason that I sort of pulled the two things that I did out to talk about here at the beginning was that it seems to me the two most common approaches and the two that have to deal with force, either targeting the leadership or, in a sense, targeting the entire group and saying, well, what we're going to do is we're going to kill as many, theoretically, if we can kill everybody or as many as possible and crush the group that way. I'm sure that there are examples of that. How often is it the case that this overwhelming application of force is actually successful because it destroys the group?
Well, first, let me just point, I just want to mention that what I'm saying, even though I'm at the National War College, is not necessarily American policy. This book was written when I was an academic at Oxford University, so I think I have to just mention that.
Well, sure. Uh-huh.
So
uh-huh.
Just to make sure that nobody misunderstands where I'm coming from. But military force and the use of repression, you know, it's been used in a number of different cases. In the late 19th century, the Russian group People's Will, Narodnaya Volya, was massively repressed by the Tsarist state. Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, there was also a massive amount of state force used against that group. This was the attempt that the Russians used against the Chechen separatists. And so they certainly, I mean, if what you're trying to do is wipe out everything, you can certainly do that with the use of military force, and you'll also incidentally wipe out those that are using terrorism. But there are a lot of side effects that don't necessarily end a campaign. Sometimes this kind of overwhelming use of repression results in exporting the problem to another country. With respect to Chechnya, you know, the local region, Ingushetia, Dagestan, and so forth, is rather unstable. And then it's very difficult for democracies to carry out a long-term program of repression, either internally or externally. It tends to work best in situations where members of the organization can somehow be separated from the general population. That requires some type of profiling, which works against the very fabric of a democratic state, and it can go against the concepts of civil liberties and human rights. Plus, it's very costly to engage in repression, and it's very difficult to sustain, particularly for democracies. But even worse, if the ideology or the cause that the group is supporting then continues on, then the group doesn't really end with the use of force. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of drawbacks with the use of massive repression. There are quite a number of historical examples, but particularly for democracies, it's difficult to do that effectively.
Mm. Well, that's is it possible to answer an overall question that says, like, of all the reasons, and I think maybe the next thing I would move on to is to talk about the possibility of actually negotiating with these groups and bringing them into the political process. If you look at all of the reasons that terror groups end, and you ask, well, in how many cases is the application of force successful? I mean, if you're on the side that considers the end of the group success, how often that approach actually does work?
Mm-hmm. By itself, not very often. I don't have a statistic for you, but the number of historical cases where you can see a kind of an exporting of the same group or its cause to a neighboring area or have it resurge is quite large. Negotiations, on the other hand, have had a little bit higher success rate, even though most people are repulsed by the idea of so-called negotiating with terrorists. It's very difficult for status quo governments to say that they're negotiating with terrorists, but about 1 in 5 groups does negotiate with a government, and sometimes they can lead to a somewhat more stable situation. Usually what the negotiations do is direct the violence to a kind of a different plane. It's not that the violence ends directly, but it's channeled into different types of channels that are usually smaller and lower than the original group would have carried out without the negotiations.
So that would, and as you say, it's difficult. No, I suppose no government really wants to say that they're negotiating with terrorists, and that it's possible that that might eventually be helpful. But at least it seems that in the short term, what that actually can do is perhaps lead to some lessening of the level of violence.
It can, especially in the long run. Of course, some groups, when they engage in negotiations, have splinter factions that are violently opposed to the negotiations, and so in the short term, the very short term, the violence can increase. But over the longer term, usually negotiations are a good way to kind of demonstrate that there's some element of willingness on the part of a status quo government to deal with the issues that a group represents. And normally over time, that prevents the group from mobilizing popular support as well as it would have done had it not been engaged in negotiations. Plus, in a pretty practical way, negotiations give quite a bit of intelligence and information about a group. You can often tell about the structure of a group and learn a lot more about what it is that a group is pursuing. You can see the fault lines within a group. Negotiations can be very effective and useful for a government.
Mm. We're getting close to our midpoint here. I have a caller here to bring in the conversation, so why don't we do that here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yeah. You gave the British example as decapitation, but it seems to me it's a primary example of where negotiations a turning away from a MI6 policy, whatever, and an outright militarization. I saw Belfast, and I saw the inequity of the Protestant and Catholic community. I mean, the community center in the Catholic side was completely surrounded by barbed wire and observation, and, you know, it's the first time I had an automatic weapon pointed at me as I was passing a bus ride on the border. So it just seems to me that, you know, in the current political climate, you can't talk about the address of grievances as part of the negotiations, because that's quote-unquote capitulation terrorist demands. Well, it isn't just the terrorists that are demanding these kind of redress. It's just that the stalemate has elicited all sorts of responses. And so I don't know how much that figures in. It seems like you said that the amount of negotiations was even something fairly small overall. So I really think that is the way to go, and sort of a grand bargain. I mean, I know it's countervailing to the current climate, but I think we should get past that. So I'd like your response. Thanks.
Sure. When you're talking about the current climate, I'm assuming that you're talking about al-Qaeda and the associated movements. Is that right?
I'm sure that is what he's talking
okay.
about.
Okay. Well, firstly, when I was laying out the different ways that groups end or decline, one thing I didn't mention is that each of the pathways is not necessarily completely unique and unentwined with the others. Mm. You can have one group, the groups that were involved with the provisional IRA and their splinter groups were complicated. And the one that I mentioned as an example of decapitation was the real IRA, which was a splinter group of the provisional IRA. And actually, one of the reasons why they splintered off was that they opposed the negotiations that the IRA were involved in. So the situation in Northern Ireland actually showed more than one dynamic for decline. The negotiations were extremely important. With respect to the provisional IRA, the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, and the final ability of the British to come up with a more stable situation there. But in Northern Ireland, it's also important to remember that the broader setting, the historical context, had changed quite a bit, and that was an element in leading to successful negotiations, with the Anglo-Irish Agreement and the Republic of Ireland playing a different role. In relation to the IRA, it helped to make it easier for the British to negotiate effectively.
And I think, although there's another thing at play here, and you're just talking about the fact that these five things don't necessarily operate in isolation from one another. One of the reasons that you point to as a reason for a terror group coming to an end is that it's lost public support. And
yes.
I think in Northern Ireland, that certainly was a factor.
Yes. Yes, David, I agree. Actually, we haven't talked about that scenario, what I call in the book implosion, but basically loss of public support, infighting, fractionalization, inability to pass the cause to the next generation. There are quite a large number of ways that groups lose momentum and undermine themselves. And one of the more promising pathways for the end of a group is to work synergistically, to work along with those natural elements, because the violence has within it the seeds of repulsion. And if what you're trying to do is to draw popular support, oftentimes that kind of violence carried out against innocent targets has within it its own means for an end.
Yeah. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest for this hour, Audrey Cronin. She's professor of strategy at the U.S. National War College in Washington. She's also a senior associate in the Changing Character of War program at University of Oxford and is author of the book How Terrorism Ends, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. We have somebody here, I believe, on a cell phone near on I-57 near Champaign, so let's get them. And this is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Well, the problem with calling things terrorism is it's what one side does when it doesn't like the other side and doesn't like how the other side is fighting back. Quote, terrorism in Northern Ireland didn't end because of bunch of guys sitting around the table having a peace agreement. It ended because the Irish government figured out how to get the European Union to pour money into Northern Ireland and build factories so that youth went to work and weren't staying out on the corner throwing rocks at the police. Terrorism when the American Indians were committing it against the colonialists ended when we killed most of the Indians. Terrorism against the British government ended when they lost the war. Terrorism against the powers that were fighting against the United States in Vietnam ended when the United States lost the Vietnamese War. Terrorism is a convenient term that's used to sort of demonize the other side. And I think it's really not very helpful to be using it in the current context because we're not going to defeat the Taliban. Terrorism is going to end in Afghanistan when the United States gets out and Afghani people, in whatever means it happens to, and it'll probably happen through remnants of the Taliban or the current Taliban, run that country. So, you know, it doesn't really help much to just kind of demonize this thing and declare that you can figure out how to defeat them. When people don't want another power there, they fight back, and they either get defeated or they win, and then terrorism ends.
Well, Professor Cronin, you can comment on that any way that you like.
Sure. Well, I agree that there are many different causes that are behind the use of violence and a lot of different types of violence. In my view, you're calling terrorism and insurgency by the same name. Many insurgencies differ from what I would call terrorist groups because terrorist groups primarily attack innocent civilians, whereas insurgencies operate as military units. They can attack military targets. They hold territory at least temporarily, and they operate much more as guerrilla armies. Although they can sometimes attack noncombatants, most insurgent groups primarily attack military targets. And so you're really talking about a kind of violence, particularly when it's oriented toward an occupying force or what the indigenous people feel is an occupying force. When it's oriented toward those military forces, that's not what I would call and didn't define as terrorism because you're not attacking non-combatants. So in my view, the caller is putting a number of different things together and describing all of these different paradigms of the use of force in the same terms. I understand where the sort of feeling comes from. It's not a matter of necessarily always siding with the major status quo power against the underdog. After all, the establishment of our country was as a result of underdogs fighting a status quo colonial power. That isn't really my point. My point is that when attacks are carried out that are specifically targeted against civilians, in order to have a broader symbolic effect on an audience, that I would call terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess it may be one of the reasons that it can be confusing is that you can a group may start out fitting the definition that we've laid out and yet can become an insurgency, can become more of a, can change and move from really being a terrorist organization to being a military organization, that is one of the kind of natural transitions that you talk about. And I suppose it's also possible for an insurgency to use tactics that we might call terrorism, if particularly if they're directed towards non-combatants, so that it can make it, in some cases, it can make things a little bit less clear-cut.
Oh, yes. These terms are not clean. And partly it's because the nature of the state and the kinds of organizations that we have in the 21st century is evolving. And so, you know, to feel that the violence that's being used against those evolving structures in a globalized world is easily categorized into little boxes is just a futile hope. But, yes, one of the ways that the use of these attacks against civilians ends is unfortunately or fortunately, depending upon whether you support the cause of the group may transition into being a more traditional type military force. And usually the first step is to become an insurgency.
And are there some cases also where they, in a sense, what we do is we see a movement from an organization that fits this framework of terrorism that seems primarily to be motivated by political a political program into something that maybe more closely resembles organized crime.
Oh, yes, yes. Actually, that's, you know, a lot of terrorist groups do use elements of crime in order to support their activities, but when they primarily focus upon raising profits and they're no longer as politically motivated, then you really have a criminal syndicate that's developing. And the classic cases today, I guess, would be the Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines and most of the narco-terrorist groups, the FARC possibly, or at least, yes, the FARC in Colombia, I guess. Mm-hmm.
One thing that we haven't talked about on your list of reasons that terrorist groups end is that sometimes they declare victory and so they disband. That, mm-hmm. that is, they actually achieve their aims. Does that happen very often?
Well, not very often. This is always a sensitive point because sometimes organizations that have used terrorism do fulfill their objectives. And because they fulfill their strategic objectives, they either become, they transition into a ruling party or they, you know, declare victory and then end. There are two examples that I talk about in my book. One is Umkhonto, which was the military element of the African National Congress. With the ending of apartheid, and then the other one is Oregon with the establishment of the State of Israel. The point really is that although it's an illegitimate means, terrorism can be used in support of very admirable ends, and sometimes those ends succeed, particularly when it was in the middle of the decolonization movement following the Second World War. You had groups that started out as using terrorism and then evolved into insurgents, and then did sometimes achieve their cause, which was the independence of their state.
Questions are certainly welcome in this part of Focus 580. Again, let me introduce the guest, Audrey Cronin. She's professor of strategy at the U.S. National War College in Washington. She's also senior associate in the Changing Character of War program at University of Oxford and is the author of the book How Terrorism Ends, Understanding the Decline and Demise of Terrorist Campaigns, in which she outlines a number of ways, and we have talked about them, that terror campaigns do come to an end. The book is published by Princeton University Press, and in the book that she makes the argument that it's important in forming anti-terrorist policy to take into consideration how it is that terrorist campaigns end. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, again, I guess I'm coming back to the question, if you look at all these possible things that could happen, and particularly I'm thinking of how it is you formulate policy and whether you decide you're going to try in any way to bring them into the fold, to have some kind of negotiation, to talk with them, whether your response is going to be do what you can to use military force and wipe them out. Maybe there are some other things that can be done. If you ask this question, well, is there any pattern here that would suggest to you what, as a state, if you were dealing with a terrorist organization, would be the most productive strategy to adopt, is there something you can learn here from looking at this very thing that you're looking at, how terrorism ends?
Well, I think that the reason why you look at the end is that it gives you the kind of strategic perspective that can help you see the elements of a campaign as it unfolds. And it's not just a matter of looking at how the group is likely to end, but it's also looking at what the state is doing and how it's perpetuating the dynamic between the two sides. Because actually, with the use of terrorism, there are three sides. One is the state or the status quo. The other is the individual group that's using violence. And the third is the audiences that are watching. And terrorism is deliberately designed to draw in or manipulate or intimidate or have some sort of an impact upon that third side, which is the audience. And if a state that is engaged in counterterrorism doesn't look at all three sides and then at how that dynamic is unfolding, they're likely to do things that work against the state's own interests, because terrorism is a strategy of leverage. And there are many different ways that it is intended to use the actions of the state in order to have an effect on that third side, the audience. It's not just a two-sided problem.
Hmm. That interests me, I guess. Can you talk some more about that?
Sure. The classic strategies of terrorism, usually people look at the relationship between a state and a group, and they see compellents, you know, which is our usual two-sided way of looking at war between two states. And, you know, we see the group trying to get a state to do something or not do something, to have an impact upon that state's behavior. And this way of looking at terrorism is pretty well established, and at times compellence has seemed to work, particularly when the goal is to try to get a state to withdraw from territory. Always the cases that are used are, that are referred to are the U.S. and French withdrawals from Lebanon, U.S. and Somalia, the Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon as well. There are a number of cases where compellence has changed the behavior of a state, but that's only one classic strategy of terrorism. It can be the case that if you look at how a particular group is likely to end, you see that there are other strategies underway. Strategies of leverage include things like provocation, which is where a group is trying to get a state to delegitimize itself in order to try to prevent that state from being able to continue to have the support of its own people. It was a very strong purpose, that is, provocation, of the use of terrorism during the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Like with the Russian group, the People's Will, they were trying to get the Tsarist regime to overreact in order to undercut the legitimacy of the regime and to lose the support of the popular, of the people. Another classic strategy of leverage is polarization, which is trying to divide and delegitimize a government from within and make it impossible to govern. To try to divide the populations, along ethnic lines or tribal lines or any other kind of inherent disagreements within a population. And then the final strategy of leverage, which is very common, is mobilization. And that is specifically trying to recruit and rally the masses to a cause either by inspiring potential supporters or intimidating them. But again, here with mobilization, the purpose is to use the reaction of the state as a means rather than an end. And an example of mobilization was the 1972 Munich Olympics massacre, which mobilized a lot of support for Palestinian nationalism. It wasn't just a matter of what the attacks were with respect to Germany. It was a matter of getting popular support through mobilization, in that case through the media. Hmm. So these strategies of leverage may be much more complicated than the way we look at terrorism as just being a two-sided game.
Hmm. I'm really interested in this idea that one tactic that terrorists may well use is to stage an action with the intent of, as you say, of provoking a reaction and maybe a disproportionate reaction from the government as a way of delegitimizing the government. And then the idea of the terrorist would be to do what they could to foment anger by the people against the government.
Yes.
I could also see a situation where, you know, one wonders, well, why it is that they wouldn't also end up being angry at the terrorists. Because if they hadn't been involved in what they were doing, then there's a first cause here, and that came before whatever the reaction of the government was. And while they might well be angry at the government, you would think they might well also be angry at the terrorists for setting up the situation that leads to this sort of escalating spiral of violence.
Sure. Well, this is where you really have to try to look at the campaign as a whole, because mm-hmm. if you understand the dynamics of the local situation, you're going to have a better sense of what the group is trying to do with respect to that audience. I mean, the classic example of provocation was with the outbreak of the First World War. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke, was relatively unimportant. I mean, it followed a campaign of assassinations in the West that had gone on for decades. You know, there was the assassination of the Russian Tsar, the French president, the Spanish prime minister, and Italian king, President McKinley, in 1901. I mean, just imagine if there had been the kinds of assassinations one after another nowadays, what kind of fear and anxiety would be the case globally. But when the assassination of Franz Ferdinand occurred, the guy who carried it out, Gavril Princip, set off a world war and was completely bewildered by that. Now, why did that happen? Of course, there were a lot of other factors. I'm not saying that this was the only thing, but it was a catalyst, not least because there was Austro-Hungarian paranoia about Serbian nationalism. So it's partly anger at the group, but it's also sometimes a sort of looking at the attacks as being from an organization or a group that they're particularly fearful of, just like when the Spanish government thought that the Madrid bombings had been carried out by ETA. There's a lot of misunderstanding and short-term error of perception in the immediate aftermath of a provocative attack, and sometimes what happens isn't what the group or the state would ever consider in their interests.
Mm-hmm. I guess I also find myself thinking about some of the thinking now that has been applied in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and I realize here now we're talking about something a little bit different. We're talking about dealing with an insurgency, but I find myself going back to your point, and you write about it here in the book, that what we have here is this dynamic relationship that involves a government, a group, and then the audience, which I guess can be sort of in framed either in a sort of a smaller frame or a larger frame, and that what the approach that's now been increasingly applied to dealing with insurgencies is, I think, a more direct kind of address to the needs and concerns of the audience, of the local audience, and trying to make the argument that to them that these people are really not on your side.
Yes.
I wondered, whether the same thing sorts of applies when you're dealing with terrorism and a terrorism group, is that you try to make that, if you're the government, you try to make that same appeal to the audience and essentially say that same thing. These people are not really on your side.
Yes, I think that's one of the most effective ways to nudge a group toward its end, to try to make sure that the population understands that the people who are being harmed by the violence in many of these campaigns is them. A lot of times groups are attacking targets that turn out to be repulsive to the very constituencies they're trying to reach. One of the classic ways that many groups have ended is through that kind of mistargeting, that horrible attacking of children, women. There are many different consistent views among human beings about violence, and the fact that most of us are repulsed by attacks on people that are not trying to attack us is a common theme that can be a very effective way to undermine a group by its own actions.
Well, I'd like to come here, maybe we have about 5 minutes or so, and come here, try to talk about where we are now and how it is that kinds of things that we've been talking about that you can perhaps learn from looking at past terrorism, how we can apply that to where we are now. And as far as the United States is concerned, I guess you'd have to say that the main focus of our anti-terrorism agenda is al-Qaeda.
Sure.
So here you have your penultimate chapter here asks this question, well, how does al-Qaeda end, and in what can maybe you learn from the past and apply that to where we are right now?
Sure. Well, again, I'm speaking only for myself.
Sure,
but
sure.
Al-Qaeda is obviously not going to end through decapitation, because this is, we've already seen unfold the targeting of many leaders. The number three in Al-Qaeda has been killed over and over and over again, even in just the last several months. And their ability to replace that person has been remarkable. So I think, the capture or killing of the leader is not likely to be the ending. Generational failure and inability to pass the cause to the next generation, that's another classic scenario, and that's not going to apply to al-Qaeda. They've already passed on beyond the second or third generation, and it's not going to be their ending. Military force and the repression of the groups, we've certainly had some important tactical successes in preventing additional attacks, but I think with respect to the question of ending al-Qaeda, we've already been able to see the strategic limitations to only relying upon military force. They're not going to achieve their cause. That's very clear. Depending upon which of the many statements that you believe, establishing a new caliphate or killing the infidels or whatever. There are many different ways that Al-Qaeda describes its goals. It's unlikely that the international system is going to be altered by their violence in such a way that they would achieve their cause. But I see a lot of elements within Al-Qaeda's violence which have within them the seeds of implosion. And really the two pathways that are most promising, or at least most likely for Al-Qaeda, I would say, would be this implosion pathway where the population becomes much less willing to support the cause. There's already a huge turning away from Al-Qaeda's message within the Arab world. And then the other possible outcome, which is a lot less cheering, is transition out of terrorism by the group into other more traditional kinds of violence. And with respect to what's happened over the last several years, particularly in Afghanistan, I think we do see an insurgency there. And to the extent that Al-Qaeda is involved, that's potentially a sign of transition. So I think the point is that for the United States, Al-Qaeda is either going to implode or transition. And a lot depends, again, getting back to these strategies of terrorism that I described, on what the state does, what we do. And our purpose should be to try to push it toward the ending that we want, which is implosion. And there are a number of ways, that we can push the group toward implosion. Just to name a few, we can articulate what we mean by Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is not a kind of a seamless international movement. It has a nebula, a central part, and it has broader associated groups. It has localized factions or individuals. Particularly, we worry about those in Western Europe. We need to be very, very clear about what Al-Qaeda is and what it is not, because every time we use the phrase or the term in a sort of a generalized way, we're strengthening the image of Al-Qaeda as a kind of a formidable movement, which it really isn't. We can exploit the internal cleavages within this group. Al-Qaeda no longer has the kind of operational control that at one point it might have had. We can hive off some of the new associated movements, the constituents, because many of the local groups that are saying they're associated with Al-Qaeda actually have very different local aims. And it's important for us to point out, or to have local governments point out, the differences in their aims. And spotlight Al-Qaeda's mistakes. Al-Qaeda is killing a very large proportion of Muslims in their own attacks. And this is causing repulsion and a backlash. And our major goal should be to try to work with that backlash. Anyway, these are all ways that I think we can push Al-Qaeda more toward implosion and less toward transition.
Hmm. Well, this, and again, I will make the point, as you did, I'm sure you don't want anybody to get the idea you're speaking for the Department of Defense or the War College, or, you know, you're speaking for anyone else but yourself.
Exactly.
But having said that, it sounds to me like it would be in our interest and important and necessary to continue to put pressure militarily on Al-Qaeda, that it doesn't make sense that we shouldn't talk about or we shouldn't think about some kind of overwhelming military victory, because I suppose that's theoretically possible. One has to ask at what cost and over what kind of time. Whereas if you work in a more subtle kind of way, that then in one sense that time will help us, but the problem is that that's going to require patience, and that maybe again that we're going to have to give up on this idea that overwhelming military force as long as we could throw enough soldiers in the fight that we could beat them that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think many people recognize that the United States, many people who comment on these things recognize that the United States has put quite a lot of its resources into the use of military force, and we're trying very hard to increase the other kinds of elements of our response, to have a grand strategy that includes civilian elements and aid and more effective use of the broad range of our tools of responding to Al-Qaeda and to terrorism. And I think that can only help.
Hmm. And though, do we have the, I guess I'm thinking of that, it seems that that's the kind of thing that relies on sophisticated skills, sophisticated intelligence, that it is the kind of thing that it's going to take people, and it's going to take people on the ground in certain places and in certain ways, and that that's something that in the past maybe we haven't been very good at.
I think it's true that we're getting better, and that we started out without a lot of experience in dealing with the kind of threat that Al-Qaeda was, especially on our homeland. You know, another thing that you see, which is, I think, an optimistic side of this situation for Americans, is that democracies oftentimes, in the immediate aftermath of terrorist campaigns and initial terrorist attacks, oftentimes react in a kind of a instinctive way and oftentimes use overwhelming force. And then they get smarter and smarter about being more sophisticated and doing just the things that you've described as time goes by. We are really learning, and that's a classic pattern, too. If you look at what governments have done, particularly democratic governments, they become more sophisticated as time goes by, and I think the United States is doing that as well.
How long, though, does that take?
Well, of course, it depends on the government. Some of them are better than others. I can only comment on what we're doing, and I think we're already a lot better than we were 5 years ago.
Well, at that, I think we'll have to finish because we've come to the end of the time. Again, if you'd like to read more on the subject, you can take a look at the book that we've been talking about. The title is How Terrorism Ends, Understanding the Decline and Demise of Terrorist Campaigns, published by the Princeton University Press by our guest Audrey Cronin. She is professor of strategy at the U.S. National War College in Washington, D.C. She is also senior associate in the Changing Character of War program at University of Oxford. And Professor Cronin, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Our program, Focus 580, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, now with 4 area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine and the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel will be with us. They're with the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana, and they join us once a month to talk about dogs, dog behavior, and training. And we hope you'll join us in the 1 o'clock hour. Your questions, your telephone calls will be welcome following the 1 o'clock news. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening with the commodity contract. In Kansas City, the December wheat contract is trading at 508 and a quarter, down 9 and a quarter. March, 524, down 10. In Chicago, December wheat, 503 and a half, down 8 and 3 quarters. March, 522 and 3 quarters, down 9 and a half. December corn, 369 and a quarter, down 7 and a quarter. March, 383, down 7 and a quarter. May, 393 and a half, down 6 and a half. July, 401, down 7 and a half. November beans, 953, down 14. January, 960, down 12. March, 965 and a half, down 11 and a quarter. May, 968 and a half, down 7 and a half. July, 975, down 5. December meal, 290 even, down 130. December oil, 36.45, down 73. December live cattle, 84.95, down 140. February, 86 even, down 122.5. November feeder cattle, 94.70, down 90. January, 96.15, down 1.